Chapter 32. Steamboat, and from Louisville to St. Louis in another. St. Louis, leaving Cincinnati at 11 o'clock in the forenoon, we embarked for Louisville in the Pike steamboat, which, carrying the mails, was a packet of a much better class than that in which we had come from Pittsburgh. As this passage does not occupy more than 12 or 13 hours, we arranged to go ashore that night. Not coveting the distinction of sleeping in a stateroom, when it was possible to sleep anywhere else. There chanced to be on board this boat, in addition to the usual dreary crowd of passengers, one Pitchlin, a chief of the Choctaw tribe of Indians, who sent in his card to me, and with whom I had the pleasure of a long conversation. He spoke English perfectly well, though he had not begun to learn the language, he told me, until he was a young man grown. He had read many books, and Scott's poetry appeared to have left a strong impression on his mind, especially the opening of The Lady of the Lake, and the great battle scene in Marmion, in which, no doubt from the congeniality of the subjects to his own pursuits and tastes, he had great interest and delight. He appeared to understand correctly all he had read, and whatever fiction had enlisted his sympathy in its belief, had done so keenly and earnestly. I might almost say fiercely. He was dressed in our ordinary everyday costume, which hung about his fine figure loosely, and with indifferent grace. On my telling him that I regretted not to see him in his own attire, he threw up his right arm, for a moment, as though he were brandishing some heavy weapon, and answered, as he let it fall again, that his race were losing many things besides their dress, and would soon be seen upon the earth no more. But he wore it at home, he added proudly. He told me that he had been away from his home, west of the Mississippi, 17 months, and was now returning. He had been chiefly at Washington on some negotiations pending between his tribe and the government, which were not settled, yet he said in a melancholy way, and he feared never would be. For what could a few poor Indians do against such well-skilled men of business as the whites? He had no love for Washington, tired of towns and cities very soon, and longed for the forest and the prairie. I asked him what he thought of Congress. He answered, with a smile, that it wanted dignity in an Indian's eyes. He would very much like, he said, to see England before he died, and spoke with much interest about the great things to be seen there. When I told him of that chamber in the British Museum wherein are preserved household memorials of a race that ceased to be, thousands of years ago, he was very attentive, and it was not hard to see that he had a reference in his mind to the gradual fading away of his own people. This led us to speak of Mr. Catlin's gallery, which he praised highly. Observing that his own portrait was among the collection, and that all the likenesses were elegant. Apostrophe Mr. Cooper, he said, had painted the red man well, and so would I, he knew, if I would go home with him and hunt buffaloes, which he was quite anxious I should do. When I told him that supposing I went, I should not be very likely to damage the buffaloes much, he took it as a great joke and laughed heartily. He was a remarkably handsome man, some years past 40, I should judge, with long black hair, an aquiline nose, broad cheekbones, a sunburnt complexion, and a very bright, keen, dark, and piercing eye. There were but 20,000 of the Choctaws left, he said, and their number was decreasing every day. A few of his brother chiefs had been obliged to become civilized, and to make themselves acquainted with what the whites knew, for it was their only chance of existence. But they were not many, and the rest were as they always had been. He dwelt on this, and said several times, that unless they tried to assimilate themselves to their conquerors, they must be swept away before the strides of civilized society. When we shook hands at parting, I told him he must come to England, as he longed to see the land so much, that I should hope to see him there, one day, and that I could promise him he would be well received and kindly treated. He was evidently pleased by this assurance, though he rejoined with a good-humored smile and an arch shake of his head that the English used to be very fond of the red men when they wanted their help, but had not cared much for them since. He took his leave, as stately and complete a gentleman of nature's making as ever I beheld, and moved among the people in the boat, another kind of being. He sent me a lithographed portrait of himself soon afterwards, very like, though scarcely handsome enough, which I have carefully preserved in memory of our brief acquaintance. There was nothing very interesting in the scenery of this day's journey, which brought us at midnight to Louisville. We slept at the Galt House, a splendid hotel, and were as handsomely lodged as though we had been in Paris, rather than hundreds of miles beyond the Alleghenies. The city presenting no objects of sufficient interest to detain us on our way, we resolved to proceed next day by another steamboat, the Fulton, and to join it, about noon, at a suburb called Portland, where it would be delayed some time in passing through a canal. The interval, after breakfast, we devoted to riding through the town, which is regular and cheerful, the streets being laid out at right angles, and planted with young trees. The buildings are smoky and blackened, from the use of bituminous coal, but an Englishman is well used to that appearance, and indisposed to quarrel with it. There did not appear to be much business stirring, and some unfinished buildings and improvements seemed to intimate that the city had been overbuilt in the ardor of going ahead, apostrophe, and was suffering under the reaction consequent upon such feverish forcing of its powers. On our way to Portland, we passed a magistrate's office, apostrophe, which amused me as looking far more like a dame school than any police establishment. For this awful institution was nothing but a little lazy, good-for-nothing front parlor, open to the street, wherein two or three figures, I presume the magistrate and his myrmidons, were basking in the sunshine, the very effigies of languor and repose. It was a perfect picture of justice retired from business for want of customers, her sword and scales sold off, napping comfortably with her legs upon the table. Here, as elsewhere in these parts, the road was perfectly alive with pigs of all ages, lying about in every direction, fast asleep, semicolon or grunting along in quest of hidden dainties. I had always a sneaking kindness for these odd animals, and found a constant source of amusement, when all others failed, in watching their proceedings. As we were riding along this morning, I observed a little incident between two youthful pigs, which was so very human as to be inexpressibly comical and grotesque at the time, though I dare say, in telling, it is tame enough. One young gentleman, a very delicate porker with several straws sticking about his nose, bedeconing recent investigations in a dunghill, was walking deliberately on, profoundly thinking, when suddenly his brother, who was lying in a miry hole unseen by him, rose up immediately before his startled eyes, ghostly with damp mud. Never was pig's whole mass of blood so turned. He started back at least 3 feet, gazed for a moment, and then shot off as hard as he could go, his excessively little tail vibrating with speed and terror like a distracted pendulum. But before he had gone very far, he began to reason with himself as to the nature of this frightful appearance, and as he reasoned, he relaxed his speed by gradual degrees, until at last he stopped and faced about. There was his brother, with the mud upon him glazing in the sun, yet staring out of the very same hole, perfectly amazed at his proceedings. He was no sooner assured of this, and he assured himself so carefully that one may almost say he shaded his eyes with his hand to see the better, than he came back at a round trot, pounced upon him, and summarily took off a piece of his tail, as a caution to him to be careful what he was about for the future, and never to play tricks with his family any more. We found the steamboat in the canal, waiting for the slow process of getting through the lock, and went on board, where we shortly afterwards had a new kind of visitor in the person of a certain Kentucky giant whose name is Porter, and who is of the moderate height of 7 feet 8 inches, in his stockings. There never was a race of people who so completely gave the lie to history as these giants, or whom all the chroniclers have so cruelly libeled. Instead of roaring and ravaging about the world, constantly catering for their cannibal ardors, and perpetually going to market in an unlawful manner, they are the meekest people in any man's acquaintance. Rather inclining to milk and vegetable diet, and bearing anything for a quiet life. So decidedly are amiability and mildness their characteristics, that I confess I look upon that youth who distinguished himself by the slaughter of these inoffensive persons, as a false-hearted brigand, who, pretending to philanthropic motives, was secretly influenced only by the wealth stored up within their castles, and the hope of plunder. And I lean the more to this opinion from finding, that even the historian of those exploits, with all his partiality for his hero, is fain to admit, that the slaughtered monsters in question were of a very innocent and simple turn, extremely guileless and ready of belief, lending a credulous ear to the most improbable tales, suffering themselves to be easily entrapped in two pits. And even, as in the case of the Welsh giant, with an excess of the hospitable politeness of a landlord, ripping themselves open, rather than hint at the possibility of their guests, being versed in the vagabond arts of sleight of hand and hocus pocus. The Kentucky giant was but another illustration of the truth of this position. He had a weakness in the region of the knees, and a trustfulness in his long face, which appealed even to 5'9" for encouragement and support. He was only 25 years old, he said, and had grown recently, for it had been found necessary to make an addition to the legs of his inexpressibles. At 15 he was a short boy, and in those days his English father and his Irish mother had rather snubbed him, as being too small of stature to sustain the credit of the family. He added that his health had not been good, though it was better now, but short people are not wanting who whisper that he drinks too hard. I understand he drives a hackney coach, though how he does it, unless he stands on the footboard behind, and lies along the roof upon his chest, with his chin in the box, it would be difficult to comprehend. He brought his gun with him, as a curiosity. Christened the little rifle, apostrophe and displayed outside a shop window, it would make the fortune of any retail business in Holborn. When he had shown himself, and talked a little while, he withdrew with his pocket instrument, and went bobbing down the cabin, among men of 6 feet high and upwards, like a lighthouse walking among lampposts. Within a few minutes afterwards, we were out of the canal, and in the Ohio River again. The arrangements of the boat were like those of the messenger, and the passengers were of the same order of people. We fed at the same times, on the same kind of viands, in the same dull manner, and with the same observances. The company appeared to be oppressed by the same tremendous concealments, and had as little capacity of enjoyment or light-heartedness. I never in my life did see such listless heavy dullness as brooded over these meals. The very recollection of it weighs me down, and makes me, for the moment, wretched. Reading and writing on my knee, in our little cabin, I really dreaded the coming of the hour that summoned us to table, and was as glad to escape from it again, as if it had been a penance or a punishment. Healthy cheerfulness and good spirits forming a part of the banquet, I could soak my crusts in the fountain with Lesage's strolling player, and revel in their glad enjoyment. But sitting down with so many fellow animals, to ward off thirst and hunger as a business, to empty, each creature, his yahoo's trough as quickly as he can, and then slink sullenly away, to have these social sacraments stripped of everything but the mere greedy satisfaction of the natural cravings, goes so against the grain with me, that I seriously believe the recollection of these funeral feasts will be a waking nightmare to me all my life. There was some relief in this boat too, which there had not been in the other, for the captain, a blunt, good-natured fellow, had his handsome wife with him, who was disposed to be lively and agreeable, as were a few other lady passengers who had their seats about us at the same end of the table. But nothing could have made head against the depressing influence of the general body. There was a magnetism of dullness in them which would have beaten down the most facetious companion that the earth ever knew. A jest would have been a crime, and a smile would have faded into a grinning horror. Such deadly, leaden people, such systematic plodding, weary insupportable heaviness, such a mass of animated indigestion in respect of all that was genial, jovial, frank, social, or hearty. Never, sure, was brought together elsewhere since the world began. Nor was the scenery, as we approached the junction of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, at all inspiriting in its influence. The trees were stunted in their growth, the banks were low and flat, the settlements and log cabins fewer in number, their inhabitants more wan and wretched than any we had encountered yet. No songs of birds were in the air, no pleasant scents, no moving lights and shadows from swift passing clouds. Hour after hour, the changeless glare of the hot unwinking sky shone upon the same monotonous objects. Hour after hour, the river rolled along, as wearily and slowly as the time itself. At length, upon the morning of the third day, we arrived at a spot, so much more desolate than any we had yet beheld, that the forlornest places we had passed were, in comparison with it, full of interest. At the junction of the two rivers, on ground so flat, and low and marshy, that at certain seasons of the year it is inundated to the housetops, lies a breeding place of fever, ague, and death. Vaunted in England as a mine of golden hope, and speculated in, on the faith of monstrous representations, to many people's ruin. A dismal swamp, on which the half-built houses rot away, cleared here and there for the space of a few yards, and teeming then, with rank unwholesome vegetation, in whose baleful shade the wretched wanderers who are tempted hither, droop, and die, and lay their bones. The hateful Mississippi circling and eddying before it, and turning off upon its southern course a slimy monster hideous to behold, a hotbed of disease, an ugly sepulchre, a grave uncheered by any gleam of promise, a place without one single quality, in earth or air or water, to commend it. Such is this dismal Cairo. But what words shall describe the Mississippi, great father of rivers, who, praise be to heaven, has no young children like him? An enormous ditch, sometimes 2 or 3 miles wide, running liquid mud, 6 miles an hour. Its strong and frothy current choked and obstructed everywhere by huge logs and whole forest trees, now twining themselves together in great rafts, from the interstices of which a sedgy, lazy foam works up, to float upon the water's top. Now rolling past like monstrous bodies, their tangled roots showing like matted hair, now glancing singly by like giant leeches, and now writhing round and round in the vortex of some small whirlpool, like wounded snakes. The banks low, the trees dwarfish, the marshes swarming with frogs, the wretched cabins few and far apart, their inmates hollow-cheeked and pale, the weather very hot, mosquitoes penetrating into every crack and crevice of the boat, mud and slime on everything. Nothing pleasant in its aspect, but the harmless lightning which flickers every night upon the dark horizon. For 2 days we toiled up this foul stream, striking constantly against the floating timber, or stopping to avoid those more dangerous obstacles, the snags, or sawyers, which are the hidden trunks of trees that have their roots below the tide. When the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.